I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. One way to learn about ancient Rome is from the movies. Spartacus, Gladiator, Life of Brian. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. You could also read Mary Beard's new book, SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. SPQR stands for Senatus Popular Quae Romanus, and translated it means the Senate and the people of Rome. Her book covers 1,000 years of history, beginning with Rome's rise from a tiny village in central Italy and the founding myth of Romulus and Remus. In its heyday, the Roman Empire was 2 million square miles, controlling about half of the known world. Mary Beard says we have a lot to learn by engaging with the history of Rome. She's a professor of classics at Cambridge University, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm nice to be here.
So what do we owe the Romans?
Is that a real question?
Just about everything?
I think we owe the Romans even more than we imagine we do. You can do the kind of roads and bridges and concrete, bathing and that kind of stuff. And you can make the Romans very practical people, you know, who kind of got things organised and,
yes,
you know, had infrastructure and lavatories and things like that.
We thank them for that.
Yes, I mean, there's much to be said for a good water supply, I think, and the Romans are quite good at that. But I think that there's a lot more to the Romans than that. I mean, and partly we owe to them a whole way that we have of talking about politics, the rights of a citizen, liberty, the nature of the responsibility of the citizen within the community. And we do tend to think a bit that the ancient Athenians, the Greeks, invented in a rather glamorous way the idea of democracy, which in a certain sense that's true. But the Romans give us ways of talking about civil liberties, and also ways of talking about how you live in a really vast community. There's, you know, ancient Athens, wonderful, very small. The city of ancient Rome is 1 million people by the time you get to 45 BC.
Which is really, I mean, the size of a big city under today's standards.
It is. It was bigger than any city in the West until London in the early 19th century. It is a vast conurbation. So it's also offering you a glimpse of ways of, you know, urban living in a massive scale, not just 30,000 people in a village.
Well, as you remind us, as you write this book, that Rome started as this tiny little village, in what was obviously the countryside. We're talking about, 754 BC or something like that.
Yes.
Or 753 BC.
So they said.
And we've got Romulus and Remus, this story that seems to sort of imprint on the founding of Rome.
Yes, the story of Romulus and Remus is still quite well known because you've got these twins who are abandoned and then picked up by the wolf, and the wolf suckles them, and that's still a logo of Rome Football Club. You know, so you can still see Romulus and Remus all over the place in Rome, and they go on to found the city, mm-hmm. but it's a very odd foundation. Now, none of this could possibly be true. One thing we have to be absolutely clear about, Romulus and Remus did not exist. They are a fairy story, but they're a terribly important fairy story, partly because, in a very weird way for a foundation legend, the first thing Romulus does is kills Remus. So the whole city of Rome is built on the idea of brother killing, of fratricide. Mm. And the Romans saw that, and somehow when they were locked in the many periods of civil war they had, they thought, you know, our city was destined to civil war. But even more interesting, I think, is that once Romulus has got his city, he's sadly disposed of Remus. He discovers he doesn't have any citizens. He's got a few maids, but not enough to start even a small village with. So what he does then is he declares his city an asylum. And he says, look, anybody can come to Rome. You can be a runaway, you can be a criminal, you can be a slave. Come here, you can find an asylum in Rome and you can be a citizen. So Rome starts in its own imagination, at sure. least, as a place. It's a city of asylum seekers. And in some ways, there's some nice parallels, I think, with America there, but also some very important resonances with the things that are going on today in Europe.
The people idea, looking for asylum.
Asylum. And one idea that the Romans would never, ever have understood is the idea of an illegal migrant. You know, all migrants were legal. You know, it was a world of migration. Now, the Romans could also be pretty hostile to foreigners and, you know, say nasty things about Syrians and be as xenophobic as anybody. But in their imagination, their city is a welcome home to all comers.
Well, picking up on this idea of citizenship, that seemed to be something that as they conquered lands and conquered people, they allowed, I guess not all, but certainly some, this citizenship, thereby building this empire.
In some ways, whether they planned it this way or not, that was the secret of their success.
Right. Rather than subjugating people,
yeah,
right?
I mean,
not that they weren't slaves.
That they weren't slaves, and not that there wasn't some terribly brutal activity, and not that I think, you know, not everybody might really have wanted to be a Roman citizen. They didn't get much choice. But it's a huge contrast with other cities at the time. That, you know, normally, you know, what does an ancient city do? When it's in conflict with someone, it goes and bashes them up. If it wins, it takes prisoners, it takes slaves, it probably imposes a financial penalty and then goes home. And what Rome did was establish permanent relationships, often of citizenship, but also of alliance, between Rome and the people it conquered.
Hmm.
And what that did was give it an enormous advantage in manpower, because the only obligation these new citizens or these new allies had was to fight in Rome's armies. There wasn't much financial penalty. There wasn't any imposition of Roman rules. It was, you fight in the army.
Was this a policy, or is it just sort of a fallout of conquering so much land and people?
We'd love to know. You know, we'd love to know if back in the 4th century BC, you know, some clever senator said, hey guys, you know, got a great idea here. Let's make the blasters people citizens, right?
That sounds very Monty Python.
You know, and that is not impossible, but I don't think it's very likely. I think it's much more likely to be, the product of a series of improvisations at different times and at different places, which ends up being hugely important. And they eventually do see what the consequence is. And by the 3rd century BC, now this is still, you know, we're still 200 years from Julius Caesar at this point, they can call on 700,000 fighters.
Wow.
So they're bound to win, you know, because people in the ancient world don't win because of very clever tactics or especially smart military hardware. They win because of the boots they could put on the ground.
700,000.
700,000.
That's huge.
They don't put them all in at the same time, but they've got that. They've got an unbeatable reserve of men.
Were they any more brutal than anyone else as they conquered, again, lands and people?
We always tend to think that the Romans were more brutal than other people. And we have this, I think, rather romantic image of the nasty Romans all dressed up in their armour, trampling over poor little peasants who are doing nothing more than doing their knitting and being peaceful.
And you're saying no.
I think no. I think this is a world in which everybody is committed to militarism. And the only way, ultimately, of solving disputes was by force. And it's not that the Romans were more vicious. They just won the whole time. And the interesting thing is, you know, why do they win? And that has to be connected to the number of men they can deploy.
What about slavery and taking slaves? How should we understand the Romans and slavery?
Well,
and we have, of course, have our own history here with slavery.
Yes, and in the UK, although we don't talk about it quite as much, there's a lot of British money came from the slave trade.
Ditto here, but yes.
But it's only really just coming to light in a public way in Britain. So, you know, nobody's guiltless on this one. And, you know, I think, you know, to put it very crudely and simply, it's you know, when people say, would you like to go back to ancient Rome? And where would you like to go back? You think, you know, look, the Romans in all sorts of ways are irredeemably awful culture. No, it is, and it is built like every other ancient culture on slavery, and we would not want to go there. I think that once you've got over that, and I think that's an important point always to hammer home, Roman slavery was in some ways, again, significantly different from slavery in other parts of the Roman world. And that's because in most cases, at least in slavery in cities, and we really don't know what happens in the countryside and in the mines, it seems that slaves were usually freed before they were too old. They were freed, you know, in time often to marry, have children, and so on. So slavery tended to be a temporary status rather than a permanent one. And when slaves were freed, and this was thing that amazed the other people who looked at what Rome was doing back in antiquity. If you were a slave freed by a Roman citizen, you became a Roman citizen with 99.9% of the rights of a full citizen. So they're not only incorporating foreigners and the enemy, they're in a sense processing their own slaves into Roman citizens. So people estimate that by the time you get to the second century AD, you know, after the first emperors, but when the empire is still in very much at its heyday, people reckon that probably over half the population of the city of Rome were the descendants of slaves.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it really was a temporary status, I guess, as long as you were, young and strong or whatever they were looking for.
Again, why the Romans did this is another of the mysteries. And I suspect we would be being a little bit naive if we thought they did it because they were nice. One argument is that it's a fairly, you know, horribly economically rational thing to do, that the last thing you want to do is to feed, clothe and house an elderly slave because they cost more to keep than the work they do. So much easier to free them and then they're off your hands. So it's very hard. Sometimes we know, but only very occasionally, that there's a real bond of affection between the master and the slave, and that slaves are freed as a mark of affection between the two. But how often that was the case? I mean, it's very easy, I think, to think that that was normal, and I suspect it was rarer than we would like to imagine.
That's Mary Beard, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation about her new book. It's called SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. And she's a professor of classics at Cambridge University. And if you have any questions about Rome, this is the place to call. This is the person to talk to. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mary Beard about her new book, SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. And she had talked earlier about aqueducts and water and other things that Romans have allowed us to build upon. And I do want to play a scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian, you know, sort of irresistible here. Here's Reg, played by John Cleese, and he's asking members of the People's Front of Judea, an independence activist group, what have the Romans ever done for us?
They bled us white, bastards. They've taken everything we had. And not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labour the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct? What? The aqueduct?
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done. And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine. Mm-hmm. Education.
Yeah, yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we'd really miss, Reg, if the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
How many times have you heard that? So how many times have I heard that? And it's still just hilarious. And true, right? Very
and in weird. A way, it's true. I think the last little bit, the they brought peace, is quite an interestingly ambivalent one, because the Romans would certainly claim that right. they had. They talk about the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And then you look at what this peace means, and I always try to say, look, why don't we translate peace as not Pax, not as peace, but as pacification.
Ah.
It sounds a bit different. I think they brought pacification.
Talk a bit about, I guess, and your focus, which I think was what makes your work so interesting, is really not on the great men, as they have been called through history, but on what life was like for regular kind of everyday people. And I'm interested in how Romans, broadly speaking, looked at women, viewed women. There certainly were priestesses.
Yeah, it's when you've finished deploring slavery, you then have to deplore the treatment of women. I mean, there is quite a lot to deplore. But again, the Romans, I think, are more interesting than you'd imagine on it. You know, would I like to go back to ancient Rome? Well, one reason, no, slavery. Second reason, no, what they do to women.
Yes.
But it's absolutely clear that women have greater freedoms in Rome than they do in most of the rest of the ancient Mediterranean world. And you know, in Athens, they were basically kind of elite women, were locked up, really, highly segregated. In Rome, it's absolutely clear that there is a big swathe of what I call ordinary women. I mean, not the toffs at the very top, nor the destitute at the very bottom, who are living a life of that we would recognise in a way. They are making contracts, they're lending money, they're running bars, they're renting out rooms, they're, you know, minor property developers.
Entrepreneurs in a lot of
little
ways.
Little entrepreneurs. Now, you know, again, we always have to be a bit careful. There might well have been some, you know, strong burly men behind them, and it, you know, I don't think it was a paradise for these women. But within the culture of Rome, there was a place for women to have some sort of economic independence, to make their own money, and to be praised and recognised as such. I mean, one of the biggest building in the Forum of Pompeii seems to have been bankrolled by a woman.
Ah.
So they have cash that they can spend. Now, that might not seem, you know, a huge compensation for having no political rights and not having a vote, but it was looked on by their neighbouring cultures as something that was quite surprising. Women, you know, women actually go out in the street, they do shopping, they live a recognisable life, and
so they're not indoors or under a whatever would be a burqa, perhaps, of that time.
They're not veiled, whereas 5th century Athenian women would have a much, much more restricted life.
Are you saying that life was better in Rome than it was in Athens, generally speaking?
I'd certainly choose it if I was a woman. I would almost certainly choose it if I was a slave. And I think that the urban infrastructure probably worked better. Now, you know, of course, we're all, you know, one feels very committed to the idea of democracy. And Rome, for part of its history, was a sort of democracy, but never in the radical way that Athens was. But the point about Athens is it was democracy for rather few men in an all-male club. And Rome was thinking about rights and how people had their own liberty, their own independence, in a way that was on a much vaster scale.
And the difference between freedom and democracy, right?
Yes. And, you know, there was no Roman would ever have gone into the forum and proclaimed the slogan democracy. They think it was generally a very bad idea. But they would proclaim and repeatedly proclaimed the idea of liberty and the citizen's liberty and the right of the citizen against the oppressive power of the state. And in many ways, what we call democracy now has inherited that as much as it's inherited some of the more theoretical, radical views that the Athenians had.
You write about the 12 tables. These were the laws of Rome. And it's focused, as you write, in many ways on just the kind of problems that we would recognize and identify, problems with neighbors, problems in the family, what to do about Uncle Harry or things like that. You know, it's so interesting.
And, you know, that's the very, very beginning of Roman law. And the first glimmering of Roman law in the 5th century BC, they're already looking at problems that we have. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what if a child commits a crime? Should you punish the child as fiercely as you'd punish an adult? And Roman law becomes a huge and very, very technical edifice. And it's, you know, not exactly fun to read Roman legal textbooks any more than it's fun to read a modern legal textbook. But what it's doing, you're absolutely right, is saying, how do you solve the problems that living in a community presents? You know, problems of inheritance, Uncle Harry, what do you do if you don't have a will? What do you do if your neighbour burns down your fence? All those kind of things. That was something the Romans wanted to get straight.
Including how to conduct a proper funeral. Yeah. And you spent a fair amount of time looking at tombstones, what people wrote on tombstones. And, of course, we can understand a bit about burial traditions. What does that tell us about Romans and how they perhaps thought about the afterlife, but also how they might comment on the current life or the life they had?
I think anybody who looks at Rome in the end has to look at quite a lot of burials.
Yes.
That's partly because that's the biggest evidence we have for the very, very earliest period. We got burials, but we don't know what they lived in. As you move on, however, the ways that people were buried and what they said about themselves on their tombstones or what their relatives decided to say about Uncle Harry on his tombstone is one of the very, very best and most vivid sources of evidence for what the ordinary people of Rome were on about, what they thought about their lives, what kind of priorities they had. And it's where you can see a real sense of individuality amongst people who are otherwise quite difficult to reach. I'm very keen in the book to reach the Roman populace, the people, but the populace don't write books.
No, they don't.
Whereas the elite write books, and it's so you get their perspective. But the non-elite, and we're not talking about the real poor here, but again, I use the term kind of ordinary, you know, people like us. They did commemorate and blazon their own personalities on their tombstones, sometimes most extraordinarily, aggressively, and rather wonderfully. And
well, give us an example.
My very favourite is the tombstone of a guy called Marcus Vigilius Eurysiches, who was probably an ex-slave. And he was a very, very successful baker with obviously a lot of baking franchises, I think. And he builds himself a really huge tomb. in a prime location just by the city walls. And it's basically in the shape of a bread oven and baking equipment. I mean, it's 30, 40 feet high, and it's kind of constructed out of marble versions of kneading bowls and ovens.
Fabulous.
And things. And on the side of it, he writes, in Latin, but the translation I'm going to give you, I'm sure, is right. Basically, this is the tomb of Mercus Virgilius Eurysaces, the baker and contractor. Get it? And you think, oh, right, here is, you know, here's a personality. Here's
exactly.
A bit of a wide boy, but, you know, unabashed, proud of himself, and, you know, great sort of urban sense of humour.
That's Mary Beard, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's A History of Ancient Rome, SPQR. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email. I see some emails as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us. I see tweets at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to get to all of our listeners here, but first I want to ask you about Cicero, because he shows up a lot in this book. Do you have a fondness in your heart for Cicero?
I do have a fondness now for Cicero. I think that he's an acquired taste. And when I was a student, I thought of Cicero as being the absolute epitome of a pompous old Roman, and the kind of person that you weren't very interested in, really. And that's partly because he wrote such a lot. A lot of it was rather formal speechifying. And it's still very heavy on the curriculum of classics courses. I imagine in the United States, but certainly in the UK. And you get a rather dull view of Cicero. Over my lifetime, I've come to see all kinds of other sides of Cicero. And when I discovered a few years ago, rather belatedly, that another of Cicero's claims to fame for the ancient Romans was that he was the funniest jokester in the whole of Roman history.
Wow.
I thought, hey, you've got to look at this guy again. You know, you think he's a boring, pompous old thing. And they were saying, God, Cicero's trouble is he never knows when to stop telling gags. Right? So it did turn me back to Cicero, and to see that he was a man that, leaving aside the speeches which are in their own right, very important. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that
sure.
We have his speeches surviving 2,000 years. Even more extraordinary, though, is that we have many of his private letters still surviving. I mean, not the original copies, but they've been copied and copied and copied. They became a kind of collection of a famous man's letters. And there, instead of seeing just the pompous old thing, you see a man dealing with all kinds of issues that seem terribly familiar to us. You know, his son has gone to university in Athens and is not proving a very diligent student. You know, he is spending too much time clubbing. What is Cicero
going to... The parents' lament, right?
Yes. and his brother has a terribly unhappy marriage, and they're always bickering, Cicero's brother and his wife. And, you know, what is Cicero going to do about it? And he occasionally quotes snatches of the rows, you know, saying things like, now you see what I have to put up with, that just ring wonderfully true. And so I've, in late middle age, I've gone back to Cicero to find a person who is much more nuanced, complicated, funny and self-ironic than I ever thought. And he's actually, because of all these things, because of the letters and because of what he wrote, he is, I think, the one person in the whole of the Roman world we can really know well. You know, that we can, you know, that we know bits about lots of other people, but for certain periods of Cicero's life, we have several letters he wrote a day.
A day.
You know?
Wow.
And at that point, you start to think, right, I'm getting a really nuanced idea of this person. This is not just a caricature. This is not just what other people said about, say, the Emperor Nero. You know, this is from the pen of Cicero himself, and it changes, and it's responding to certain all sorts of different circumstances that we can start to imagine.
Well, and he's been quoted many times. Our own Senator Cruz of Texas. This was about a year ago when there were the fights about immigration in this country, and he spoke Cicero in the halls of Congress and in the Senate chamber.
He did, and he's not the only one. There's one very, very famous speech of Cicero when he's denouncing actually a what he called a would-be terrorist, whether the guy was a would-be terrorist or not, you know, we will never know. But yeah. Cicero is convinced that this man called Catiline was about to try and really overthrow the state. He gave what became his most famous speech, where he denounced him. He stood up in the Senate House and he denounced him. And it starts with a wonderful phrase, "How long will you go on abusing our patience, Catiline?" And that phrase, if you Google it, it comes up all over the place. You know, Cruz used it against Obama. There are people using it against Francois Hollande. And I found a wonderful little picture, which I put in the end in the book, of some slightly elderly Hungarian protesters protesting against their government. Yeah. And the men are holding up a banner with the first words of that speech, actually in Latin, you know, "How long will you go on? Quousque tandem," it says. I thought, you know, Cicero would have been so pleased to think that that moment of oratory and his denunciation of his enemy was being repeated and repeated and repeated.
It's so interesting that you have found Cicero to have this wonderful sense of humor, because you wrote a book called Laughter in Ancient Rome, I guess to sort of get at that part of people, about a minute before a second break here, but just getting at people's senses of humor. Yeah. What does that say about them?
And some of it's very familiar. I mean, I'll tell you a very quick joke, which is man meets a guy in the street and says, I thought you were dead. And the other one says, "No, you can see I'm alive, I'm here." And the guy replies, "But the man who told me that you were dead is much more reliable than you are." I mean, not brilliant, but no, but you can see the point.
Yes, he's standing right in front of him, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And I can see lots of people want to join the conversation. Mary Beard is our guest, and she's a professor of classics at Cambridge University. She's written a number of books about Rome, a book about Pompeii, and the new one is called SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. We're going to take a very short break and open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Cicero probably would have liked all of that as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mary Beard about ancient Rome. I do want to play a clip or a scene from the 1960 film Spartacus. It's about a slave rebellion against the Roman Republic, directed by Stanley Kubrick and starring Kirk Douglas as Spartacus, who leads in this film the slave army. And this is the famous scene where after the Romans defeat and recapture the slaves, they try to find the rebel leader.
"I bring a message from your master, Marcus Licinius Crassus, commander of Italy. By command of his most merciful excellency, your lives are to be spared. Slaves you were, and slaves you remain, but the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus."
"I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
A a scene from Spartacus. So, Mary, what's the real story of Spartacus?
Well, it's a wonderful movie and it's a wonderful story, but it's quite a long way from the truth, I'm afraid. And Spartacus did leave... He did lead some kind of slave revolt. They were a load of gladiators, probably treated pretty roughly. They were well-trained military men, actually, and they used that to escape from their gladiatorial barracks. And they did score an instant success against a rather sort of ramshackle Roman legion. But it's absolutely clear that there was not much anti-slave ideology here. You know, they were wanting to escape. They were not trying to overthrow the system of slavery, and that seems never actually to have been on the agenda at all in Rome. And they must have been joined to last so long. They must have been joined by quite a lot of other malcontents and ex-soldiers and other sort of impoverished dissidents who are hanging around South Italy. And I, in the end, come to the conclusion that I don't want to ruin the image of Spartacus because I still love that. But you know, in the end, this is a kind of fag end of Roman civil war, honestly. Yeah. And sadly, it does get horribly put down. And despite what we hear there, as we know from the movie, they do get crucified all along the roads leading into Rome.
Was that something very Roman to crucify people?
It was a fairly standard form of punishment, though interestingly, it was seen even then as a particularly degraded form of punishment, and Roman citizens were exempt from crucifixion. So you could crucify slaves and you could crucify foreigners, but you couldn't crucify Roman citizens, which, you know, is why in the early history of Christianity, St. Paul, who's a Roman citizen, gets beheaded, but St. Peter, who isn't, is crucified.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Chris from Flower Town joining us on Radio Times. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is regarding... one of the gifts that was given to us by the Romans in ancient Rome is the beautiful Latin language and the literature that came from it. But what do we have, what has been captured in history from the vulgar Latin and the vernacular of the everyday citizen of ancient Rome? And what do we have that has remained and what can we learn from it?
Chris, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
That's a very interesting question. And there is much more than you'd imagine. And I mean, you're right to say that we read very high Latin literature and a lot of it is truly mind-blowing. But if you go, and I think Pompeii would be a place you'd go for this, if you go and look at what is scrawled on the walls, all the graffiti in the city, the little jokes written up on Pompeian bars, there you start to see the Latin of the real people. And you start to see, because they're often spelling it phonetically rather than in what we think of as correct Latin spelling, you start to see how words were pronounced, and you start to see the slightly different forms of spoken Latin, which some of which in the end kind of carry through as an underbelly of a high Latin culture and emerge again in what we call now much later vulgar Latin. So there is quite a lot of interesting linguistic work done on just what the people spoke and how.
That's so interesting that you find it in things like graffiti, which would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And
I mean, that's what people were doing.
That's what people are doing, and they're writing graffiti about all kinds of things, you know, from being cross with their girlfriend to saying what they've just done in the local brothel, to writing down things because they don't have notebooks, writing down little memos like shopping lists to themselves.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let's see what Luann from North Hills has to say. Luann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you, Marty.
Sure.
Yes, as an Irish-American, but an admitted Anglophile, I must say, which is a bit of a conflict, I've always been perplexed how it is that the British were able to subjugate the Irish. And a lot of reading that I've done has, you know, pointed out the fact that the English had been imbued with Roman organization, hierarchy, law, etc., and which enabled them to to be a single kingdom and exert influence in that way. I'm wondering, is there any real understanding, though, of how it was that they were able to subjugate the Britons, who were Celts, and yet not the Scots and the Picts or the Gaels?
Well, Luann, let me see what Mary Beard has to say. Thanks for the call.
That's a very interesting question, and I think you can get almost to an answer. It's partly about geography and terrain, that Roman legions were pretty much unbeatable on broadly flat land. In a pitched battle, you couldn't defeat a Roman legion, really, if you were the Britons. That becomes very different when you go up to the mountains, particularly Scotland, but also Wales, where you can't deploy your legions in the same way, and you become incredibly vulnerable to guerrilla warfare from people who know the territory themselves very well when you don't. And it really does look as if Rome never particularly found a method of deploying its military force in that kind of area. Now, they may have thought it wasn't worth it. I mean, but they'd sat down and wondered how to do it. I'm sure they could have thought of something, but they didn't. They actually didn't. Although they did. There's one lovely story of how when they get to Anglesey, and you can just see the Irish coast from Anglesey, one Roman commander says to another, I reckon we could conquer that with one legion, don't you? But they never did, nor did they try.
Luann, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me just read a couple of emails and questions we have here. Question from Kevin. What was the predominant religion in Rome? Did it shift over time?
Roman religion is entirely different from anything that we know today, or at least the traditional Roman religion. It's a very diverse, incorporating polytheism. There's lots and lots of gods. And quite interestingly, just as the Romans incorporate new citizens, they're also, by and large, very happy to incorporate new gods. And when they conquer new countries, gradually those people will be brought into the Roman sphere and given citizenship, and so will the gods. And there were plenty of temples of the Egyptian gods, for example, in Rome. What becomes a problem for the Romans, and this is where big change and big conflict comes, is that when they come up against people who are convinced there is only one God, that kind of principle of incorporation is no longer possible. And so the Romans have enormous conflicts, first of all with Judaism, and in the end they manage to make some kind of accommodation with Judaism, but shortly after with Christianity, which is in a sense a subsect of Judaism at the time, and the standoff between Christians who would not accept that there were large numbers of gods, and the Romans actually being completely puzzled by these people who had their own god and that was fine, but why on earth couldn't they recognise the Romans too? That in the end leads to fully fledged persecution at times, and in the end the Romans lose out. The traditional Romans, you lose out.
Thanks for that question. I want to go back to something you said, that in its I guess heyday, Rome had 1 million citizens, and I'm trying to imagine, 2,000 years ago, what it was like to live in a city of 1 million people. I mean, as advanced as they might have been, that had to have been
noisy,
smelly, noisy,
noisy, smelly, traffic jams. I mean, okay, there might not have been motorized transport, but there were carts, piling up at the crossroads. And we have some wonderful descriptions of what it's like, walking along the streets of Rome at night. And, you have to watch out because all the residents on the upper floors are likely to be pouring the contents of their chamber pots onto your head.
Another reason maybe you wouldn't want to live in Rome at that time.
True.
Let me get Michael from, looks like Morgantown to join us. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
A few years ago, I saw a documentary, it might have been BBC, where some historians and engineers recreated an authentic Roman bath. And one of the things they mentioned, as I recall, is that the Romans didn't have soap. That the men, who knows what the women did, the men would wrestle and then cover themselves in olive oil and use a strigil to scrape off, the scum. And it just was kind of a mind-blowing thought that these folks didn't know how, as colonists in America, you drip water through an ash barrel and you mix it with animal fat and you have soap. Is this a true fact that Romans did not have soap?
That is absolutely true. They used, olive oil was the, had many more uses than just cooking in the Roman world. And personal hygiene was one of those, because they certainly had no soap. They also, and I find this almost more amazing, they had no toothbrushes and they had no toothpaste. And we often say, oh, look, they had such a kind of, decent, healthy diet, no fizzy drinks. Their teeth, were really pretty good, but they had no dental hygiene whatsoever. And there are an awful lot of poems by rather witty Roman satirists complaining about people's bad breath. And I suspect that was a major problem.
And there were problems with gout too, right?
Gout, yes.
Which tells you something about diet, I guess.
We always like to think that gout goes along with red wine, but I'm assured by doctors that this is not true. But you get gouty people, hernias. You get unmended hernias. And there are lots of jokes about people going to the baths and... with a less than gentle view of other people's bodies, sitting and pointing and laughing at the old guys with hernias.
Oh, goodness. This is a kind of Hollywood question. How common were Roman orgies?
Depends what you mean by an orgy.
But it's people getting randy with each other. And
I think an orgy is kind of more sex than we like. I think that...
Is that your definition?
Yes, yeah, that's my definition of an orgy. I think that sort of Hollywood picture of people reclining on couches and saying, pass the grapes, Marcus, before taking all their clothes off. There may have been a few examples of that, but most people were actually much more sober and much less excessive sexually. We partly have the Christians to blame for this. Christians looked back and said, do you know why Rome fell, why we won? Because they were having sex all over the place. And we are partly the inheritors of Christian propaganda about Roman morals.
A question from Brian, who asks, so what are some of your favorite sayings from that time period? Does she have a favorite Latin slang phrase?
Favorite Latin slang
phrase. Right. Thinking, well, I guess, of that graffiti.
Ones that I can that I can repeat on the radio.
Yeah, well, that's the other potential problem.
Yes, there's quite a lot you couldn't do on the radio. I like the little graffiti left on the wall of a bed and breakfast at Pompeii, which says, landlord, I'm sorry, I've wet the bed, but you didn't provide a chamber pot.
It's always about the bathrooms, isn't it? You're not done with Rome. I mean, it seems like this is endlessly fascinating and fun for you.
I think it's tremendously fun, and people often imagine, they say, how can you work on Rome? This is such a long time ago. There's so little evidence. And that's simply not true. And one of the things I say, I think, in the book is that there's more actual now published literature survives from the Roman world than I could possibly read in my lifetime. From all kinds of things, from sort of science fiction stories of going to the moon to letters and medical writing and law codes and poetry and nasty satirical squibs and history. Amazing.
Well, it's been such a pleasure, Mary Beard. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting us all excited about Rome. Her book is called SPQR, subtitled A History of Ancient Rome. She's the author of a number of books about Rome, a book about Pompeii as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. Diana Allen, our intern this year for Radio Times, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.